Welcome to Yahoo Finance Presents. I'm pleased to bring in our guest today, Mark Spitznagel, the founder and chief investment officer of Universa Investments, a hedge fund that specializes in convex tail hedging and investing. He is also the author of a new book, Safe Haven, Investing for Financial Storms. Mark, great to have you here today.
My pleasure, Julia.
Well, you rarely give interviews, and that's why it's also great to have you. And you know, you might come across as a bit of a mystery to some folks out there. And in your new book, Safe Haven, you position yourself in a bit more of a contrarian light. Yet when one looks at the returns of Universa Investment, you all over the last 11 plus years have averaged north of 100% according to audited returns from Ernst & Young. And again, as I mentioned, you come across as a bit of a contrarian in this book. And you know, when I look at returns like that, it makes me wonder, Mark, what are people missing? How do you juxtapose people thinking you're a contrarian with this evidence, the returns here, showing how successful you all have been?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it is true that the way Universa invests is really probably the most bearish expression that one could have as an investor. And yet at the same time, you know, my clients want the markets to go up. So why is that? I mean, it's obviously because it's a risk mitigation strategy. It's a particularly efficient and explosive risk mitigation strategy. But, you know, so when you think about the returns of what we do on its own, you know, I can't speak too much about that, but, you know, as a trader and investor, you know, I sort of wear two hats. One is sort of a prop trading hat, you know, where we think about edge and sort of long run average returns on the standalone basis. And then we wear a risk mitigation hat. And that is, what do we do to the end user's portfolio? How do we transform that end user's portfolio by mitigating the systematic risks in that end user's portfolio? So, and the two are very different. I mean, you have to think about them differently. Now, it's really the risk mitigation hat that I would argue is more important. I mean, clearly, you know, I've been doing this a quarter century. So, you know, there's a lot of tricks to this, and we feel like we certainly have demonstrated edge in our approach. But kind of the point of my book is that really risk mitigation, we shouldn't look at the parts in that way. We shouldn't look at sort of in a reductionist way, the parts in a risk mitigation strategy, but rather it's what you get from the whole. And certainly, you know, as the adage goes, the whole is all, it can be very different than the sum of the parts. And that can be true in risk mitigation. It needs to be true for risk mitigation to be cost effective.
You know, it's an interesting point you bring up. And I should also note that what you've written here, you said this is the manifesto of you and your hedge fund firm, Universa Investments. And as you were just talking about this idea of, you know, risk mitigation, what is it that folks generally get wrong about this concept?
Well, unfortunately, when it comes to risk mitigation, we just approach it wrong from the start. You know, our goals are even wrong. And this, you know, really we have modern portfolio theory to thank us for this, but it's just kind of a heuristic of investing that you need to take more risk in order to get higher returns, in order to get more wealth at the end of the day. And as you take less risk, your returns are going to go down. So it creates something of this sort of dilemma. I call it, you know, the great, great dilemma of risk. We're really damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. You don't take enough risk, you're not going to get enough return. You take too much risk, and you know, you certainly are vulnerable to types of crashes we've seen in the recent past, and lowering your return. So you somehow model portfolio theory, we got to find some middle as ground, and we've got to get our Sharpe ratio right, and then we're going to, you know, crazy add some kind of crazy leverage in order to somehow be better off at the end of the day. To me, none of that really makes sense. It's really sort of financial theater or a storytelling is what modern finance is all about. And it really, I just don't think it leads people in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So I think this is just really where people get it wrong is thinking about it as a trade-off. And there really is another way. Risk, the goal of risk mitigation, like the goal of investing, shouldn't be to lower volatility at the cost of returns. The goal of risk mitigation, like the goal of investing, should be to raise our rate of compounding over time. And again, flies in the face of everything we know from modern finance, but it is actually a reasonable expectation to have. It's a reasonable goal to have, even though it's difficult to achieve.
Yeah, you see it you see it differently. You know, that cost-effective risk mitigation should actually raise a portfolio's CAGR over time. I want to circle back though to this idea of this great dilemma of risk and explore that a bit further. You know, because you think when you put something in your portfolio as an investor, you put it in there because you want it to make you wealthier. Is that correct? And I want to dig in a bit more. And you know, why is it that folks are missing this idea that you put forth here?
Well, again, I just don't think that we've sort of taken this first principles approach to thinking about what it is we're trying to accomplish. So we just kind of jump into it. We jump into this idea of diversifying our portfolio without even first asking ourselves why we're doing it and what we expect to accomplish in doing it. And this was sort of my whole point in bothering to put these words to paper, is I do think people need to think about this from a sort of a higher level, a first principles approach to what it is we actually want to do as we build. Investing is, after all, allocating capital to the different things in a portfolio. And modern finance tells us that this is all about sort of this dogma of diversification. But as the great Peter Lynch calls it, and as I borrow, this really ends up diversifying one's portfolio. So again, it sort of begs the question, what was the point of it all?
Yeah, diversification. I like that way of putting it. I want to step back. Do you think that maybe some of this, you know, kind of like the modern finance dogma here, has it kind of led us to the situation? I've heard other, you know, well-known investors talk about the underfunded pensions and liabilities and some of the challenges that those will eventually encounter down the road. Do you think this has kind of gotten us to that place? Has this contributed to some of those challenges?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head right there. This is the great dilemma of risk at play in the marketplace. We see it, you know, you can sort of pick your pension. One either has to sort of roll the dice and kind of go for it to avoid that underfunding problem, or one cowers in the weeds, you know, in order to avoid that underfunding problem. But neither are going to get them to where they need to be. You know, we saw what happened when too much risk was taken, when we saw various financial crashes in the past, and then we can see what happens when these underfunded pensions don't take enough risk. So they're kind of trapped in the middle here, and unfortunately, modern portfolio theory just can't help solve that problem without the use of leverage, which in and of itself is, as I said before, is just a crazy idea that one needs to embed leverage in one's portfolio in order for the risk mitigation to be effective. Whenever someone is offered that as a solution, they should run away, I would argue.
You know, it's interesting, some of these kind of like conventions of modern finance. Why do you think it is this way? Is this just like human behavior? I know you're someone who studies you know, the philosophers and, you know, maybe some of the human behavior here. If you had to kind of narrow it down, what do you think it is?
Well, you know, there's a little bit of a history lesson here that we were sent on the right path a few hundred years ago by Daniel Bernoulli. He kind of figured it all out for us, what risk mitigation is about and how it really is about raising the rate of compounding and how that is possible. But, you know, it kind of happened in mid-century where, you know, without naming names, we just modern portfolio theory kind of sprung out of this very reductionist view on building a portfolio. And, you know, the math was very convenient. I think that's a big part of the problem, is it's sort of we start with a solution and we try to find a problem to solve. The mean variance approach works nicely with the mathematical tools that we have. And using this sort of approach where we maximize the geometric average, our rate of compounding, which is like you know, we've been talking about, is really all that really matters in investing. That doesn't lend itself to the clean math necessarily that modern portfolio theory gave us. So I think that's part of the problem, is we've got sort of financial engineers with a solution to first and then finding a problem. Without first analyzing what the problem is and seeing what the right approach is.
I want to bring up your background. So again, you have your way of investing. It's obviously paid off. You know, last year there's a lot of attention around universe investments, returning 4,000% in the first quarter. And you all do well when these financial storms happen. What was it in your background? You mentioned at the top of this conversation, you know, being in the pits in Chicago, and you also take this more mathematical, quantitative approach to investing, looking at the markets, also looking at, you know, studying the philosophers, if you will. How did your background kind of lead you here?
Well, my background as a pit trader was really all about focusing on taking small losses. So minimizing your losses when you're wrong, such that you can maximize them when you're right. And I think that's sort of relevant, you know, when people think about returns, you hear news about returns and crashes that universe has. I mean, I always like to de-emphasize that, because really at the end of the day, any punter can devise a trade that does well in a crash. The key is how do you do in a crash, an insurance-like payoff like universes, how do you do in a crash relative to the rest of the time? So that's really what matters. So these long swaths of time that really matter. And the key to that is, you know, sort of maximize the asymmetry of that payoff. And as a pit trader, this is kind of what I was taught, really starting as a teenager, that this is what trading is. Trading is taking very small losses and taking very large profits. And of course, being taught this, what happened was I was taught this at a very impressionable age, something that is diametrically opposed to the way pretty much all hedge funds operate, which is take a lot of little losses and occasionally maybe experience some type of a negative tail event.
I want to step back for a sec from your book. I know in your first book, The Tao of Capital, you talk about monetary policy, and it's no secret that you have been outspoken on the Federal Reserve. Kind of framing up, though, what's transpired, you know, markets reaching new highs, unprecedented monetary experiment that we've been on for several years now. How do you kind of think about the Federal Reserve, Mark?
Well, I mean, so the Federal Reserve is manipulating the most important sort of information parameter in the economy, and that's interest rates. I think we need to be sort of occasionally we need to remind ourselves that financial markets, you know, we all know this idea of supply and demand in financial markets. Financial markets are this great homeostatic system. And they, with sort of this sort of corrective feedback mechanism, and the control parameter, of course, are prices. And really, the biggest of them all is interest rate. It's sort of the price of time, if you will. And so, by manipulating that interest rate, which is what central banks do, what they're basically doing is messing with that homeostatic process, that corrective process, because basically all the interest rate does is it regulates debt and savings, right? As debt accumulates relative to savings, we see interest rates go up. And as savings starts to grows relative to the demand for debt or credit, we see them go down. And that sort of regulates them. It's sort of a crowding out effect. We all know that that the price mechanism serves this function. In sort of everyday items in the economy. But of course, the interest rate is even more important because it kind of regulates everything. It regulates all sort of capitalistic activity and savings and borrowing. But what happens when we manipulate that, now we have this sort of Hayek, what the Austrians would call a Hayekian information problem. No longer is information conveyed by the interest rate. So what does that do? It sort of rips apart this great homeostatic mechanism that is the marketplace. But I would argue it doesn't remove it. It basically just sort of delays it and sort of concentrates it in time. I think a good way to think about this is sort of when you're driving, is very much this sort of feedback mechanism where you make these minor corrections. And I think that's a good way to think about what the market does, the price system does. But think when you drive on ice, all of a sudden you have this delayed feedback, so that when you do something, nothing happens until all of a sudden it does. And I think that's really the way we should think about what central bank interventions do to this homeostatic system is they delay it and they concentrate it through time, such that ultimately, you know, history shows and logic, I think, dictates that ultimately sort of this homeostatic corrective feedback mechanism rears its angry head. And that's really what a crash is. But it's made worse and it's delayed through this central bank interventionism.
So I know no one has a crystal ball here, and you talk about no one can predict the future, but I mean, how do you kind of even think about probabilities of the long-term consequences? Like, if it does rear its ugly head, are we talking about financial crises that could be even worse than the ones, I mean, I've experienced in my lifetime, or maybe you've seen in your lifetime?
That would be my expectation. But having said that, so I don't have to trade that. I don't have to trade with that expectation. I remain very much agnostic to all this, which you kind of led with at the start of this. That's important. I mean, I think it's important to invest in a way that you don't rely on this sort of grandiose forecast. You know, I think it's a misnomer when people think that investing is about forecasting. I think that generally everybody agrees that, but it really shouldn't be about forecasting. It shouldn't just be about forecasting this sort of expectation, because that we're never going to get that right. We're never going to get that right. And of course, the range around these expectations we forget is massive. It's just massive. So how do you trade based on or invest based on one expected value? You get one path. You know, we just get one path. We don't get an average across all possible paths in the multiverse, right? We get just one. So it's a little bit crazy to invest based on the one. So we do need to be agnostic to that. Easier said than done. So I do have the luxury of thinking about this without having to sort of bet my beliefs in that sense.
I like that you said that you remain agnostic and you get that one path in the multiverse. But not everyone's wired that way. I don't know if it's something you think about, but like when we go back to, like, you know, kind of thinking about human behavior in general, it does kind of make you wonder, though, what kind of the longer term consequences of this could be. We've seen more people enter this market, especially in the last, year plus. So just kind of how you think about it philosophically, like our markets in general and, you know, the dependency here on the Fed.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think we have a majority of people active in the marketplace now that don't have this concept of a range of outcomes that we will see, we could see, we will just randomly selecting from. I think that's a concept that would be lost on most people that they have one expectation. They're gonna invest or trade based on that. But you know, when you think of another way to think about this in terms of risk mitigation is that. You know, across this whole range of possible ways that things can go, if your risk mitigation strategy still doesn't give you some good payoff, even should we see a crash and a recovery like we've seen in the past, if you still find yourself underwater and poorer because of it, that's another indication that, you know, when it comes to risk mitigation, the cure is often far worse than the disease itself. So though I you know am telling you that I have this expectation of destruction in the future in the financial markets, that doesn't necessarily mean that someone should just hide away, because that in and of itself may not be the best strategy either. That's kind of like the dogma of diversification, thinking that just by lowering your risk, it's going to be better for you. There needs to be people need to think that through more carefully. But again, I think that you just approach this knowing what your goals are, realizing that your risk mitigation may be costly. It may be costly even if we see the crash that someone expects. You may be poorer for it. And as long as people understand that wasn't the goal, then at least we're being consistent in our approach.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like in the book how you talk about, you do address kind of the everyday investor, probably the investor, our audience is comprised of the kind of retail investor, and that this is not a how-to book, it's a why-to book. And, you know, kind of if we stay on this topic of, you know, safe havens or maybe some of like the myths around safe havens, a couple I want to tick off with you and just explore as to why it's not a safe haven. Let's start with gold. How should people be thinking about gold? That's not the safe haven that you might expect it to be, the one that's often talked about.
Well, as I show in the book, it's just rather inconsistent. There's historically been a huge range around how it's done mitigating the systematic risk in the portfolio. It's actually pretty darn good. It relies certainly on sort of these inflationary expectations that we've seen in the past. It remains to be seen if that's even the environment we're really going to go into. So, but gold is pretty darn good. I mean, you just have to understand that there's been a lot of noise around it.
So it's more like tactical, I think, is one way of putting it.
It is tactical.
Yeah.
So, and which is a great thing to bring up. We need to juxtapose tactical safe havens versus strategic safe havens. So strategic would be something that you should always have in your portfolio, allows agnosticism, whereas tactical is something where you really have to have a view and you better be right in that view or it's not going to do anything for you. And it kind of is inconsistent with the whole notion of risk mitigation in the first place, which kind of presumes that we don't have a crystal ball.
Mm-hmm. Another one that's come up lately in recent years, you probably know where I'm going, is Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general. Maybe you've seen some of the folks talking about maybe that one being an inflation hedge, certainly a lot of the rhetoric around it. What do you make of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin? Do you think that could be a safe haven?
I think it's a very, once again, it's an massively noisy safe haven. We just don't know. So this is as tactical as it gets. You know, I do think it's a fundamentally terrific idea, the notion of cryptocurrencies. You know, and in general, I'm aligned with the thinking behind it and aligned with many of the people who are positive on it. I think we're thinking about it in the right way. We're thinking about the destruction of our money through the actions of central banks, and we're thinking about the dangers in the banking system as a result of that. So I think that people are thinking about it right, but unfortunately, as terrific an idea as that is, it's turned itself sort of into a casino, which is a very bad idea. So it's kind of like killing the golden goose, I fear, in many ways. So as a safe haven, I would argue that's not a very good safe haven at all. But I do think that it's a terrific idea.
Terrific idea. Do you own any, maybe personally, or I mean, I doubt Universal does, but have you dabbled in cryptocurrencies?
I probably shouldn't talk about that.
Okay, no problem. Let's bring up treasuries. Curious your thoughts, because that's kind of like when you think of structuring a portfolio, the old adage, what was it, 60-40. So how should investors think about bonds in their portfolio?
Well, particularly today, of course, with rates being where they are, I think it's very challenging to think of that as something that's going to be cost effective. I don't see how it could possibly. You really have to look in the past and you struggle to find how even bonds were cost effective historically. You have to really have reached out the yield curve in order for them to have been. Really, you know, the way most people would invest in sort of the shorter dated bonds, it's really bonds really represent I think the canonical case of sort of the mean variance approach of lowering the volatility in your portfolio but being poorer because of it. But again, where we are today makes it all the more challenging. I think it would be very hard for bonds to have going forward provide the cost effectiveness when even in the past they really weren't able to do that. Mm-hmm. But of course, bonds are the canonical safe haven, really. I mean, it's what people think of when they think of risk mitigation, when they think of diversification and balancing a portfolio. And I think that right there is. I think to focus on that is really focusing on the problem of our goals, not really, I think, being clear about our goals.
Mm-hmm. You know, I will say this, your book is incredibly thought-provoking. I've seen a lot of folks talking about it, even saying that it's going to cause them to rethink how they want to allocate to a portfolio. So, again, not everyone can replicate what you do at Universa, certainly, but they can learn lessons here, especially around risk mitigation. So I guess to leave our viewers some parting thoughts, again, I know it's not a how-to book, but what would you say to that kind of retail investor audience? What would be the biggest takeaway from them when it comes to like relooking at their own portfolio allocation?
Well, what I try to provide for people is certainly not a how-to book. I mean, no book is ever going to tell you what to do successfully as an investor. If someone ever claims that, I would recommend against very much. What I try to provide is sort of logical, practical framework, really, just for approaching risk mitigation, thinking about risk mitigation, thinking about safe havens, and thinking about the goals, what it is that we want, what our expectations for them should be in the first place. Does it require some grandiose crystal ball in order to be effective? Or should risk mitigation be something much more than that? Should it be there specifically because we don't have that grand crystal ball? So to me, that's much more powerful for a retail investor than some random trade that wouldn't even be relevant in 2 days, right? So I do think that if people think about that and it gets them to revisit, I think that the investment profession shouldn't be too happy about that, because I think there's so much storytelling, narrative, even snake oil being sold in this sort of in the name of this dogma of diversification, that's basically just making people poor and not really even providing very much risk mitigation for it. I think there's a lot of forces out there that don't want people to revisit the sort of practical framework that they're using in approaching portfolio allocation.
Yeah, sounds like that part of the financial system could be ripe for some disruption, maybe some awakening here to some of the ideas that you share here in Safe Haven.
I think you're right.
Well, Mark Spitznagel, the founder and chief investment officer of Universa Investments and the author of Safe Haven, Investing for Financial Storms, I thank you so much for joining us on Yahoo Finance Presents.
Thank you, Julia. It was my pleasure.